was promised, we want to begin a study of the book of Daniel this evening. There are some handouts on the back. I don't know how many of you found them. I put them back there with the bulletins. They were there this morning, and I forgot to mention them this morning. But they give a little more information than what we're going to be able to go over in the lesson, as far as some introductory material and notes, and actually some questions there as well on chapter 1. So I'll try to have those out there on Sunday morning before the Sunday evening lesson each week. So you can take those, look over them that afternoon if you want to, or use them during the lesson or whatever. They will give a little additional information. We're going to try to cover a chapter a week. We may not be able to do that with every chapter, but we'll have some additional information in those notes then that we don't have time to go over. What we want to do this evening is look very quickly at some introductory material. And again, there's more detail in those notes as far as the time frame, what's going on with the northern kingdom going into Assyrian captivity, and then the southern kingdom going into Babylonian captivity, which is what's taking place here at the beginning of Daniel. But as far as just a little bit of introductory material, first of all, the author. It's not known positively who the author is. Most we believe it's Daniel himself, but certainly Daniel is the primary character of the book. It is about the things that he does as he works there within that Babylonian empire as a captive, really, but one who goes up to a very prominent position within the government there in Babylon, and then as they are conquered by the Medo-Persian Empire, he continues to hold a high rank there as well. He was carried away by the into Babylonian captivity in the second or the third year of Jehoiakim. We're told in chapter 1, verse 1. He was a prophet, but again, he was also and probably better known as being a statesman. A statesman to a heathen court. In fact, in the very strictest sense, he doesn't meet some of the qualifications that we normally think of in a prophet, but he was a prophet in a more general sense. Jesus refers to him as a prophet. He is the one who receives the revelations in the second half of the book. And so again, he's the primary character, the one who's receiving these messages from God. And again, we would certainly assume it's the one that is recording them. Jesus, in Matthew 24, verse 15, explicitly speaks of Daniel when he speaks of that spoken by the prophet Daniel, talking about verse 24, 15. So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place. And so that's one of the prophecies that Daniel receives, and Jesus does refer to that and calls Daniel by name. As far as the dates, again, we believe that the things were recorded as they were transpiring. And they were transpiring from about 605 B.C. to 536. And so, again, we would assume that that is the time that it's written. As is usually the case, some of the critics have said, no, it was written much later. They give it a date of about 175 to 150 B.C., and their reason for doing that is because trying to take the supernatural out of the prophecies that Daniel received and waiting until after those things, many of those things had taken place, saying someone's writing them after the fact. But that certainly does not fit what we see taking place in Daniel. The theme of the book, God rules the nations. God is in charge. And certainly a very good reminder as we deal with some of the things even that we deal with within our own nation, that God is still in charge. As we question things and so forth, that God hasn't forgot about it. God does know what's going on. Passage chapter 2, verse 21, He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. Chapter 4, verse 17, is the sentence by which the decree of the watchers, the decision of the word of the holy ones, to the end that the living may know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom He will and sets over it the lowliest of men. In chapter 4, verse 32, this is the chapter where Nebuchadnezzar loses his mind, so to speak, and he's out living with the beast in the field. And then it says, "And you shall be made to eat the grass like an ox, and 7 periods of time shall pass over you until you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom He will." So God is in charge. We come to chapter 2. We have the depiction of the four different nations. And certainly God is in charge. He knows exactly what is going to transpire through those years. The purpose of the writing, again, would fit with that theme. The primary purpose, to show the sovereignty of God in dealing with nations and kingdoms. Again, reminder that He is in charge. But certainly another purpose that we see, a predictive purpose, it clearly sets forth the establishment of God's eternal kingdom. In fact, that's the main emphasis, really, of the book. These earthly kingdoms don't matter that much. But it's the God's eternal kingdom and how it is going to come about that is the thing of significance as we deal with the book of Daniel. So we won't spend quite a bit of time as we go through looking at that. In chapter 2, verse 44, it says, "And in the day of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, nor shall the kingdom be left to another people. It shall break in pieces all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever." Of course, that kingdom that he's talking about there is the church. God's kingdom, the kingdom of God. We're part of that kingdom today. And it shall never be destroyed. Whenever this earth ceases, it will be handed over to the Father and will exist throughout all eternity. As we come to the book itself, we have a division, really, of the 12 chapters, the first 6 being narrative, historical in nature, 6 historical events in the life of Daniel, broke down by those chapters, each chapter dealing with one of these events. Of course, we get into the last 6 chapters, it changes quite a bit. We get into these visions and a lot of very figurative type things. But the things in the first 6 chapters are much more literal and a little easier to understand and interpret. So chapter 1, Daniel raised to prominence from Jerusalem to Babylon to the king's court. Exit from Jerusalem, exile in Babylon, and entrance into the king's court. You might say that chapter 1 is setting the stage for the rest of the book. It's putting Daniel in the position that he needs to be in then for the rest of the events that are recorded in this book to unfold. First couple of verses, the expedition of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar is the king of Babylon against Jerusalem. It says, beginning in verse 1, "In the 3rd year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God." Well, the historicity of the date of this is really can't be satisfactorily denied. 606, 605 B.C., right in that time frame. Now, some have found fault here and said, well, the city did not actually fall until later on, until 597 under King Jehoiakim, or Jehoiachin. We can go back to 2 Kings chapters 23 and 24, also over in 2 Chronicles chapter 36, and we can read of the events that are taking place there, really involving the last 3 kings of Judah. But really, we have no issue here as far as a contradiction. Daniel does not say that the city was taken in the 3rd year of Jehoiakim. That is the time that he and these other captives were taken away. He doesn't say it falls. He simply says that Nebuchadnezzar besieged the city in that year. He took some of the choice of these people. He took some of the vessels of the house of God. And so when people find fault, they need to make sure and look at what Daniel's actually saying. He doesn't say that it failed then. But that was kind of this first wave in his attack, and he ends up drawing back for some personal reasons. And then he's going to come later in 597 and also again in 586, as we'll see as we go through. The real difficulty that where we have an alleged contradiction here that is a little more valid until you look at it a little deeper is between Daniel's statements and the statements of Jeremiah. In Jeremiah's statements, in Jeremiah chapter 25, verse 1, also 46:2, and 25, verses 8 through 14, Jeremiah talks about these things taking place in the fourth year of King Jehoiakim. 25:1 equates the fourth year of Jehoiakim with the first year of Nebuchadnezzar. 46:2 states that in the fourth year of Jehoiakim, Nebuchadnezzar defeated Pharaoh Necho at Carchemish. And again, that's talked about a little further in the notes that were handed out. Well, Daniel's statement, again, in chapter 1, verse 1, says in the third year of King Jehoiakim. And so again, some point to that and say, well, we have a contradiction. Certainly on the surface, it looks like maybe we do. But it is very easily resolved, again, when we realize the difference between the ways that different people dated things. If you remember, we ran into that before with the 3 days that Jesus was in the tomb. And the way that the Jews count time being a little different than the way that we count time. The way that we normally think of time, Jesus wasn't in the tomb 3 days. But because they counted a part as a whole, the way that they count time, he was in the tomb for 3 days. Well, it's kind of the same deal here. The Babylonian method, which Daniel uses, versus the Palestinian method that Jeremiah is using. This chart makes it just a little bit clearer. The Babylonians didn't count the first year as the first year. They would count the first year as the year of ascension. And then the second year as the first year and so forth. And so you have the year of ascension for Daniel's way of counting versus the first year and Jeremiah, the Palestinian way of counting. And then as you go forward, the years are one off from each other. And so Daniel tells us it's in the third year of Jehoiakim. Jeremiah tells us it's in the fourth year of Jehoiakim. They're talking about the exact same year. It's just, again, a little different way of looking at these things. Well, as we look again a little bit at the history, we see the different campaigns that Babylon brings against Judah. The first one was this one in 606, 605 B.C., Jehoiakim is the king of Judah. And as we read there in Daniel, he's taken away. The Lord gives him into the hand of King Nebuchadnezzar. This is the time that some of the nobles are taken, including Daniel and his 3 friends and others that are taken to Babylon. Second invasion that Nebuchadnezzar leads against Jerusalem is in 597 B.C. when Jehoiachin is the king of Judah. We can read about that again in 2 Kings chapter 24. That's when 10,000 of the Jews were taken to Babylon. And then the third invasion, the third and final one where Jerusalem was destroyed, was actually in 586. And Zedekiah was the king at that time. He had been placed there by Nebuchadnezzar. He was just kind of a puppet king under Babylon. But he had decided to rebel against Nebuchadnezzar, and that's when he comes and tears down the walls. He destroys the temple, just annihilates the city of Jerusalem. And again, we can read about that in 2 Kings chapter 25. And so that's when the rest of the people are taken into captivity as well as these things being destroyed. Well, we're coming to verses 3 through 7. We have Daniel and his friends introduced into the king's court. Beginning in verse 3, then the king commanded Ashpenaz, the chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. So the king calls for certain ones of these nobles that have been taken from the children of Israel. If you notice, it's a pretty detailed list of the qualifications that they had to meet. These things had actually been predicted by Isaiah some 100 years before they began to unfold. Isaiah 39 verse 7 says, "And some of your own sons who will come from you, whom you will father, shall be taken away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon." And so, exactly as Isaiah had said, that's what the events are taking place. But the king desired what it says, youths without blemish, good-looking, intelligent, smart. Yeah, probably leave me out pretty quick. But he wants people that will be able, both from an intellectual standpoint and from a look standpoint, be able to stand before the king and be very impressive people. As he talks about youths here, he's not talking about children, but what we might call young men, probably about 14 to 16 years old. So again, that's pretty young to be taken from your home and taken off to a foreign country and away from all your people, away from your way of doing things, your worship to God, and all of those type of things. That's the situation we see Daniel and these other youths in. They were to stand before the king in the king's palace. They're going to be there in the king's presence doing various roles. And so the preparation process. The king assigned them food and wine from his own table. He's providing for them what was in his mind the very best in preparation for what they're about to do. It says, beginning verse 5, "The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king." So there's going to be a preparation time of 3 years. They're going to be given the very best education, what the king considers to be the very best food, the very best drink, everything to prepare them for this very important position within the government there, within the service of Nebuchadnezzar. Well, Daniel and his three friends, we find out, are among those that are called, beginning in verse 6. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar. Hananiah he called Shadrach. Mishael he called Meshach. And Azariah he called Abednego. So we see that they were from the tribe of Judah, all four of these young men. And then their names are changed. They're given Babylonian names, most likely to remove the reference to God that they had in their names. They were trying to get them away from their culture and indoctrinate them into the ways of Babylon. They don't want them acting like Jews as they're there serving the king of Babylon. So they're trying to get them away from all of those things and indoctrinate them into their way of doing things. Actually, as you look at the four names, their Hebrew names, all of them have a reference to God. If you look at the ending of the words, if you see an EL, such as Daniel and Mishael, that EL stands for God. Daniel's name means God has judged. Mishael means who is what God is. And then the other names, if you have an AH, such as Hananiah and Azariah, that means Jehovah. Hananiah's name meant Jehovah has been gracious. Azariah's name meant Jehovah has helped. And so all four of these young men have a reference to God, or Jehovah God, in their names. And so their names are changed. Daniel's new name, Belshazzar, means protect his life. It's not known exactly what the other names mean. But probably, again, probably something to do with their gods, actually, in reference to their various so-called gods. But their names are changed. Everything, trying to get them away from that culture. Well, we see beginning in verse 8, a very impressive example. Again, especially when you consider that these men are probably 14, 16-year-old. You know, we think that's still a kid. And yet here they are in a very important position, making some very important decisions based upon their faith. So, an energetic faith. Daniel purposed in his heart, or resolved in his heart, what it was that he was going to do. And he was uncompromising. His uncompromising faith leads to courage. Leads to him standing up against the situation that he's in. You know, he could have very easily, these kings back in this time thought nothing of putting a person to death. He's already a captive. He's been brought in. You know, the king could have took his life with no thought, almost. But yet he still stands up and takes a stand. So beginning verse 8, but Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who assigned your food and your drink. For why should he see that you are in worse condition than the youths who are your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king. Daniel resolved. He purposed in his heart. He made a decision about what he was going to do based upon his faith. And once he's made that decision, he's going to stand strong on it. He's not going to be willing to compromise. But he's going to take a very strong stand. To have taken the king's food and the king's drink would have, in Daniel's mind, involved defilement. Now, most likely, this was food that had been offered to idols and the religious practices that they had there in Babylon. Again, they had a myriad of different gods that they believed in. These pagan gods, and they offered sacrifices to them. And then that food would be brought to the king and to others to eat. And so that's the food that would have been brought to Daniel and these other captives. You know, Paul gives some instructions to the Christians at Corinth concerning a similar practice, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 20 through 23. But God rewards Daniel's faith. It says that God gave Daniel favor and compassion with this chief of the eunuchs, this person that's been put in charge over them. Literally means God gave Daniel to kindness. This man to show kindness to Daniel. Daniel's request was based on the principle of faith and respect. You know, he doesn't go about this in some cocky way or some haughty way, but he does take a firm stand. Well, we can see there that the eunuch doesn't necessarily have a problem with it, other than the fact that he's scared that the king will come back on him if they end up not looking as good as the other people. And so he's afraid from that standpoint. Daniel refuses to give up. He doesn't seem to really get the satisfaction from the chief of the eunuchs in verse 10. We see as we're going into verse 11 that he goes then to the steward whom the chief of the eunuchs has assigned. So evidently there was a chief of the eunuchs over the whole group, and then he had assigned other people under him to certain ones of these captives. And so then he goes to the one, the steward, and he gets some satisfaction from him. Verses 11 through 16, we have 10 days of proving. Daniel comes up with a plan, you know, if you'll do this for 10 days. Then come back and look and see how things are going. Verse 11, then Daniel said to the steward whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see." So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. And at the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. So it was a 10-day testing period. Of course, 10 is a number of completeness. I think here it is a literal 10 days. But they're going to be given vegetables to eat. The older King James Version, the American Standard Version, say pulse. That's talking about vegetables. Vegetables to eat, water to drink, instead of this meat from the king's table, the wine from the king's table. At the end of the 10 days, it was proved that they looked better than these other people. They didn't look worse, as the eunuch had assumed that they might, but they do indeed look better. God is continuing to take care of them. And so, because they did look better, says they were better in appearance and fatter or fuller in flesh than those who ate the king's food, then the steward of the eunuchs continues to take away that food that's provided for the king and give them instead the vegetables and the water. Well, certainly as we look at Daniel's resolve here in his faith, there is a lesson that we can learn. The very nature of faith demands courage. You know, if we're not willing to take a stand for our faith, then faith is not worth a whole lot. The type of faith that compromises at the first sign of danger is not really faith at all. You know, we may stand in the church building with our Christian brethren and take a hard stand, and we get out in the world and opposition comes, then what do? Well, if we're willing to compromise, then we didn't really have faith. Daniel, again, a great example of faith here. It's not just empty words, but a true and lasting faith. Something believed in but not lived is not really faith. Daniel resolved in his heart, he purposed in his heart what it was that he was going to do. Faith is daring. Faith takes risk. You know, when was the last time we took a risk for our faith? That we really stepped out in faith, as we say sometimes, and did something based upon faith, like Daniel is doing here. How many times are we willing to be inconvenienced for our faith? Faith must be lived. Galatians chapter 2, verse 20. It must be contended for. Jude, verse 3. It must be defended. It must be proved. 2 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 5. Faith makes the difference between pretenders and contenders. Those that are willing to stand solid upon their faith. Of course, part much of what we saw in James in our study we just concluded, talking about the strength of life is not possible without testing. That testing, that strength comes through testing and our faith being tested. Faith stands strong when one purposes in his heart. One resolves what they're going to do and then stands upon that. Well, as we continue through the text, verses 17 through 21, entrance into the king's service. This 3 years of preparation is being completed, and Daniel and his friends are going to be put into the actual king's service and in very important positions as they go forward. But notice, first of all, the attainment of Daniel and his three friends are gifts of God. God is taking care of them all through this process. He's guiding the process. He's taking care of them. It says in beginning of verse 17, "As for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill and all literature and wisdom." Now, part of this 3 years of training, they're being trained in those things. But this says God gave them this learning. He gave them the skills and these things that the Babylonians were trying to train them in. So these gifts of God were for discerning between truth and error and the Babylonian wisdom. The Babylonian religions and Babylonian wisdom was very mystical, very pagan. And so certainly these men needed that wisdom of discernment between which paths to go down and which paths not to. We'll see that a little clearer when we come to chapter 3, verse 6. But in addition to the gifts that were given to all four of these young men, it seems that Daniel's goes a little further. In the last part of verse 17, Daniel had understanding of all visions and dreams. Now we know that was one of the ways that God communicated at certain times, especially in the Old Testament times. And it was something that was very big in Babylonian culture. And God oftentimes used the culture that people were in and the things that they were used to in order to teach and to guide. Well, we know that this was a miraculous gift. We come to chapter 2 and Daniel is able to do something no one else could do, as he actually gave the dream as well as the interpretation. That would certainly take a miracle in order to happen. But Daniel possessed the ability to see visions and dreams, as we'll see when we come to chapter 7, to declare interpretation of the dreams and the visions of others, as we see in chapter 2 and again in chapter 4, to know whether a vision was of God or was merely something that was concocted in our own mind as a regular dream that we might have. To declare the true interpretation of one's vision and dream. You know, Nebuchadnezzar, when we come to chapter 2, it seems to not have a lot of trust in his interpreters because he wants them to give him the dream, what he dreamed, as well as the interpretation. You know, someone, if he told them the dream, it'd be very easy for them to tell him back an interpretation. How do you know if it's true or not? Or how do you know if it's not just something they made up to go along with it? Daniel's interpretation was always true. Daniel was in a situation similar to what we found Joseph in the end of the book of Genesis, and the visions that are being given and the interpretation of those. Well, we come to verses 18 and 19. We have Daniel, his three friends, are summoned to the court of the king. At the end of that time, the three-year period, when the king had commanded that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king spoke with them, and among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore, they stood before the king. And in every manner of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all his kingdom. So as the king spoke to these young men, he found none like these four that had taken the stand, that had taken a stand based upon their faith, and God has blessed them in this very special way. He's given them gifts. He's blessed them, and so none are found like them. In fact, they're found to be 10 times better than all the magicians. Again, 10 is a complete number. I don't know here if it's a literal 10 times or just a completely ultimate, so much better than these other people are, superior to these magicians. Magicians, again, are something very common in these pagan type countries. We see them over and over here in the book of Daniel. We see them in Genesis and in Exodus in the country of Egypt, who was also very mystical. He also mentions enchanters here, which was referring to some specific sort of magic. We don't know exactly what was entailed in that. But God is blessing them. He's putting them in a position in order to achieve, again, what it is that he desires. We come to verse 21. We see that Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. Verse 21. Once again, we see that some people find a difficulty here because of chapter 10, verse 1. where it says, "In the third year of King Cyrus of Persia, a word was resolved to Daniel, who was named Belshazzar." And so we see that Daniel was still in place there in chapter 10, verse 1, in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia. But once again, there's not really a conflict here. The preposition until does not exclude going beyond that, does not exclude future from that. And so this is simply saying that he was still there in the first year of Cyrus. Whenever the Medo-Persians come in and overthrow the Babylonian government, that he is still there. And he is going to continue, as we see in the rest of the book, on for a while past that. Well, we might say then, why was this particular year listed? Why does it mention in particular the first year of King Cyrus? Well, this was a very important year. It was a year of great importance to the Jews because it was the beginning of a new era and the end of exile. The Persians are going to have a very different way of dealing with captives than what the Babylonians had. The Babylonians' way was to get all the people out of their native land and bring them and put them in some other land where they were fugitives, you might say, and they felt they could better control them doing that. The Persians, when they came to power, their idea was to let them go back as long as they would be subject and not try to rebel against Persia. They allowed them to go back and be their own people within their own nations. And so that's what we see when the Persians come into rule, that they began to allow the Jews to go back and reestablish themselves back within Palestine. In Ezra chapter 1, beginning verse 1, it says, "In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation through all his kingdom and also put it in writing. Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you of all his people, may his God be with him. And let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and rebuild the house of the Lord, the God of Israel. He is the God who is in Israel." And so that would be the beginning then of them being able to go back to their own land. They came in three waves. They'll go back in three waves. The first one under Zerubbabel, and then led by Ezra, and then the third one under Nehemiah. But Daniel is able to live throughout this entire period, the 70 years of captivity. Daniel is going to see every day of it, including his people finally getting to return. But this chapter really puts him in place again for the things that will follow in the following chapters. He's now in a prominent position within the court. There in Babylon, he'll rise to a much higher position in chapter 2 as he interprets the dream for Nebuchadnezzar. And he'll be able to do some great things for the Lord and have a great influence in that position that he has. Well, next week we'll look at chapter 2, and there's no way we can cover chapter 2 in a week, so we'll probably break it into a couple of different lessons. Again, I'll try to have the handouts out by Sunday morning so you can pick those up. Lesson is yours. Is anyone here this evening who needs to respond to the Lord's invitation? Daniel, in the next chapter, will talk about that everlasting kingdom. That kingdom that is the saved. Are you a part of that kingdom? If not, why not become a part this evening? Maybe you need the prayers of your brothers and sisters. If we can assist you in any way this evening, if you'd let your need be known as we stand and sing.